Michael Nicholson, Reel 34. Talking about the Gulf, Michael, and your refusal of taking the NAPS tablets, do you have any knowledge of Gulf War syndrome? Have you taken an interest in this?
Yes, we did the television special for ITV on it, a one-hour special, and we travelled extensively. I mean, it's probably the best research programme that I've ever done, other than, you know, one in Vietnam. But we spent quite a few months researching it, and travelled quite extensively. And we travelled to America, many parts of America. We travelled to Canada. We travelled to Bosnia, Kosovo, Croatia, went to Baghdad, all places where the depleted uranium shell had been used. Now, I don't know if you know, but the accusation is that, or the suspicion is, that the depleted uranium shell, which is, if you know what it is, it's a normal shell, but it's tipped with depleted uranium, which is the hardest known metal, and it can pierce armor plating. I mean, 4 or 5 inches of armor plating goes straight through like a hot knife through butter, and so it can blow up a tank with ease. Now, it's said that once those shells explode, the uranium tip disintegrates into billions of pieces, particles of ceramic dust. And if that dust is inhaled, if it's ingested, if it gets into the lungs, then it causes all kinds of problems. If it's on the skin, apparently it doesn't seem to cause any problems. But once it goes into the system, it is there forever. I'm told it has a life of 1.5 billion years. So once it's in, and there is no cure for it. Now, we met an awful lot of British soldiers and American soldiers and European civilians and patients and doctors in Baghdad who are willing to swear whatever that their disease is caused by the inhalation of this depleted uranium dust. Now, of course, the military deny all this. The governments deny it. Military, for the obvious reason that if it was proven that it was lethal, then they would be obliged never to use it again. And of course, it is a very, very cheap. It's very cheap to get, because it's an offshoot of the nuclear power industry. It's nuclear waste, if you like. And of course, it is the most effective weapon yet devised. It's called the lethal weapon. The governments, of course, are determined not to acknowledge the fact that it could be a health risk, because if it was proven, and if they acknowledged the proof, they would be involved in countless thousands of claims, compensation claims. So that's the reason why there has been such an obstacle from both military and government. But all the places we went to, for example, those who had worked in the Gulf, we spoke to British soldiers who were not at the front line, but were handling casualties who had come back from the front line, who had been involved in explosions of depleted uranium. Medical people, mostly. People who went to recover damaged tanks which had been hit by or been close to a depleted uranium explosion and would have inhaled it. We spoke to an American major who was sent out to the Gulf to assess the risk of cleaning up tanks and vehicles that have been involved in and around depleted uranium explosions. And he was appalled at the lack of precautions. even though the Americans had issued, and this is astonishing stuff, even though the Americans had issued a video outlining the dangers of depleted uranium and showing how you could prevent the inhalation by wearing masks and wearing protective clothing and so on. And this video was completed long before the Gulf War, but was never released. No American soldier ever saw it. Also, in the British Army, a memo was sent to various units in the army warning them of the dangers of depleted uranium dust, and that, again, the measures to be taken. And again, that notice was never circulated among frontline troops. So there was a deliberate maneuver by governments on both sides of the Atlantic that the risk of DU should not be made public. Now, it's only just been coming out, one, that these things existed, these notices and these videos existed, and two, that they were never distributed. So it was obviously a maneuver on parts of both the both governments and the military that soldiers should not be aware of what's going on. I think the answer that I heard from one officer was that it was such an effective weapon that if there were casualties on our side, well, there were casualties that would have to be taken into account, and acceptable casualties. Of course, that's very well when you're sitting in staff headquarters. It's not quite the same when you're out in the front line. So that was the military side. We also, I must say that we went to a factory to show how seriously but privately the Americans were taking the risk of DU. There was a factory producing these things in Pennsylvania, and it was suddenly discovered that dust from the factory, radioactive dust, because that's the problem, radioactivity. Radioactive dust was actually being found something like 12, 14 miles away from the factory. The wind was carrying it. And so immediately that factory was closed down and destroyed. So it just shows you how, in private, the government was taking the risk very seriously indeed, but keeping it private. So we also went to places where DU, depleted uranium shells, and bombs had been used in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Baghdad. Now, in Bosnia, we went to a place where United Nations planes had bombed a factory using depleted uranium bombs, tip bombs, and shells. And we discovered in that village that the incidence of cancer was something like 40-fold the norm. And even more interestingly, because of the ethnic cleansing in that country, people who had lived in that village were forced to move elsewhere. I think they were Serbs who were forced to move out of this area because it was mostly a Bosnian Croat area, and were forced to move elsewhere to a Bosnian Serb area. And the fascinating thing was that they took their disease with them, because when they moved into that new area, the incidence of deaths among them was vastly out of proportion to the deaths of among the normal population. So it seemed to us to be conclusive proof that those people who lived near that factory and in that village had inhaled the dust from those explosions and were suffering as a consequence. In fact, all but one of the 11 men in that factory had died of cancer. It seemed to us pretty conclusive proof, and we spoke to a doctor, a Serb doctor, in that town where the refugees had gone to. She was under no illusions whatsoever that these people had died an unnatural death. We went on to Baghdad, And as you'd expect, because it was part of the propaganda, the doctors there talked about the high incidence of malformed babies, the fact that children who had been close to a depleted uranium explosion were all suffering some kind of cancer, mostly leukemia, and a cancer that affects the bones. And I said to them, "But I'd expect you to say this because it's part of your propaganda to blame any kind of disease upon the attacks by the UN forces." And they said, "Yes, and we knew you would say that, but it doesn't change our opinion. We are doctors, and we have never seen such a high incidence of cancer-related cases ever before, and they've all occurred since the bombing." Of Iraq.
Did you see the cases yourself?
Oh yes, I saw the cases, but I'm not. I could be easily persuaded by any doctor that what he says is true. I have no medical training, so one has to take face value. What was interesting is we also interviewed a professor who specialised in this kind of. He became a specialist after the bombing, and had done a great deal of research. And he showed us various charts and tables and photographs to prove the fact that so many incidences were cancer cases, which could only be explained by radioactive dust in the lungs and elsewhere. And I said again, "Well, you're a propagandist for the Iraqi government." He said, "No, I have submitted these papers to the Royal College of Surgeons, of whom I am a member," he said, "and have been for some many years. And these papers have been accepted by the college," he said, "so that they are internationally published papers which have been accepted internationally." So pretty conclusive proof, I have to say. And yet when we presented all this proof to the authorities, they pooed it and said, it proves nothing at all. We went to Dr. Liz Mooney, who is the Minister for Veterans, British War Veterans, at the Ministry of Defence, again, presented with all this evidence, still refuses to believe that that there is any connection. And it's obvious why, because he can't. If he does, he makes the government liable for hundreds of millions of pounds worth of compensation claims. And yet we met plenty of British Gulf War veterans who were suffering, fit men before they went, suffering from undiagnosable diseases when they came back.
How about the psychological effect? Had it affected them psychologically as well?
Well, only as much that they knew they were dying and felt that they ought not to be dying for that reason. I mean, if you're dying of a disease that can be diagnosed as just bad luck, a virus that you pick up, or an accident that didn't repair itself, well then, you're sad, but you accept the fact that it's one of those things. But here are men who went to war to kill the enemy and find that years later they're being killed by something invented by their own side. And I think that's what they found hard to live with. The war... it continues to kill long after that war is over. And there's going to be another war in Iraq, no doubt, and almost certainly they'll be using depleted uranium shells again.
Could it have been these diseases and the malformation of babies, could this have been caused by the pollution caused by Saddam Hussein, with the oil wells and other things?
this obviously was an aspect that we had to examine, that when you think of the cocktail of drugs that these soldiers were given, the British soldiers and American soldiers were given, they weren't just given one injection, they were given half a dozen injections containing a great cocktail of drugs to save them from this and this and this and this. So, I wonder whether the body could take it, and maybe, as you suggest, that these diseases are not caused by DU, but are caused by these cocktail of drugs. Add to that the enormous quantities of insecticide that was sprayed in the area because of mosquitoes and other things, willy-nilly just sprayed over tents in tents. Coupled to that, the fact that the Allies bombed Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological factories. There's no doubt that they blew them up. And of course the wind would carry the contents of those factories hundreds of miles. Add to that the oil fires that blazed away endlessly for weeks on end. You know, all these things in the air and in the blood could all come together to kill the strongest man. So there has to be that rider, doesn't there? There has to be that caveat that the research seems to prove to us that it's depleted uranium dust. And remember that the government's had warning notices which they never sent out, so they must have themselves known there was something wrong. But as convinced as I am that DU was the killer, you have to remember that the air was so polluted in that time, in that area, carried by the wind, added to the fact that these men were being injected with enormous doses of drugs that would probably kill the strongest horse. You know, it's very hard to come to the finite conclusion.
But the fact that you travelled to Baghdad, as well as Kosovo and Bosnia, America and Canada, would you say that the DU was the common factor that came up, you know, that all these people were subjected to?
Well, they're all, yes. Again, you know, I'm going on eye evidence and the evidence of doctors. They were all suffering from some kind of cancer, leukemia, deformity of the bones, bone cancer. And doctors tell me that it was a consequence of radioactivity. You see, there is so much radioactivity down south of Basra, where the great Iraqi convoys were, you know, finally destroyed, that no one's allowed to go anywhere near them. The radioactivity is so strong even now.
One wonders about the coming war. You know, it seems as if this is a definite possibility, and whether you know, the troops will be worried, whether there will be any problem there.
We've made enough of it, and certainly the Gulf War veterans in this country are quite a powerful lobby. They're very active themselves in publicising all this, and one would like to think that they've spread it far and wide, you know, their concerns. But I say, as a Scotty today, you know, doesn't think that far ahead, and still implicitly trusts the boss. And if the boss says, "Oh, it's perfectly safe," then he's going to believe him. He's hardly going to mutiny.
How do you feel about it, though? The fact that, you know, you expect to go back into this area, does it worry you at all that?
I suppose it does slightly worry me, but I'm not going to be in the front line like the other guys. I mean, I should be. If they start to bomb Baghdad with DU shells, DU bombs, then of course one would be worried, very worried. But one won't know until it's too late.
When did you first go to the Balkans?
I went shortly after Croatia declared independence, which is 1991. As you know, after the death of Tito, they managed to hold Yugoslavia together. But I think with the collapse of the Soviet Union, each little kind of power monger all decided they would grab their own little territories, and little by little Yugoslavia broke up. Slovenia was first, of course, but Slovenia was so small, and also it was very close to Austria, so Belgrade, the Serb regime in Belgrade, after a couple of days of sporadic fighting, let Slovenia go its own way. But then, of course, the next door was Croatia, and Croatia being very large and quite powerful within the Yugoslav conglomerate, it broke away too. And the Serbs didn't want that. And, of course, the war began. For a while, the first time I went was to Zagreb, and we thought there was going to be street-to-street fighting there, because the Serbs had quite a large garrison inside, as you imagine, because the Serbs ruled Yugoslavia, even though Tito himself was a Croat. The Serbs were the dominant caste, and they had... there were Serbs in every aspect of every aspect of Yugoslav. The economy was ruled by them, the military was certainly ruled by them, the politics was ruled by the Serbs. I suppose that was the reason why Yugoslavia broke up, because it was one race ruling the others. And I remember very well the story we did when we realised that the Serbs were going to invade Croatia. We were doing some stories in Belgrade, and we were on our way back to the hotel, and suddenly we were overtaken by a convoy. Now, it was quite usual to see a convoy of say 10, 12 trucks going from one barracks to another, one garrison to another. But this just went on and on and on, and then suddenly what passed us was some tank loaders with tanks on, armoured personnel carriers going through, and this was a big convoy. I imagine it was like the one that journalists saw at the outbreak of the Second World War when the Germans went into Poland. Claire Hollingworth describes, the long convoys of tanks when she realised that the war was about to begin in Poland. And so we followed them. We followed this convoy out of Belgrade along the motorway towards Zagreb. And we thought, my God, are they going to actually invade Zagreb? Because that would have been absolutely bloody. But then they turned right and went off. And we realised that they were actually going to go into Croatia. And declare war on Croatia. And that was the story that I put out that night. People didn't believe it. I was asked to tone down my reports to say that possibly, but I said, look, I've seen them cross into Croatia. I've seen tanks going into Croatia. I've seen thousands of troops in lorries going into Croatia. We've actually interviewed a couple of them. They stopped at some of the villages and I interviewed them. But yes, we're going to Croatia. So that's how we knew the war began. Of course, then we followed the war pretty regularly from then on. It was very much street to street fighting, village to village fighting, and everywhere they went, every village was destroyed. It's hard looking back now to appreciate the savagery of those first few months. I don't think anyone quite expected it. No one could have dreamt that they would do scorched earth among their own people, because we were still calling them Yugoslavs. And of course it ended. For me the nightmare kind of rose to a crescendo and then ended with a place called Vukovar. Now Vukovar was a very pretty town, large town, medieval town on the banks of the Danube, and it was large enough, and because it had a river on one side, it felt safe enough to defy the Serbs. So the Serbs held it under siege for 3 months, 3.5 months I think it was, and I think somebody said it was the longest siege since Stalingrad. I mean, Stalingrad was in years, but this was months. But they surrounded the town and just simply bombarded it. I mean, you watch day after day just these huge fuel guns sending their shells in, mortars going in. It was relentless. And when eventually it ended and the people in Vukovar surrendered, it was difficult to think that anyone could have survived because they lived most of their time in the cellars. We were the first into Vukovar. We drove down in, and it was just totally destroyed. Beautiful old houses, as I say, medieval town, everything destroyed, many, many dead. I remember in my commentary saying, we have seen more dead today than I can decently describe, and more dead than I can possibly show. It was that bad. And we went to a hospital. I don't know how we got in, because I remember Martin Bell coming out saying he'd been refused entry and getting very upset about it. But somehow we got in, and down in the cellars was the ward, because the hospital itself had been partly destroyed. So all the wounded were in the cellars, and there were hundreds down there, lying on the floor, as tight as sardines. The operating theatre was, you know, kind of old lavatory that had been converted into an operating theatre. We found one little gem. We found there was a little baby there, only about, I think only about 8 weeks old, 6 weeks, 8 weeks old, with tubes in and out of her. Her mother had been hit with shrapnel while she was pregnant, and the shrapnel had gone into the baby, but it survived. And the doctor said, the woman doctor said, that actually given nurses and doctors had given their own blood to keep the child alive, because there was no way of getting blood. So we did that story, and across the road was where they laid out their dead. They couldn't keep the dead in the cellars, of course, so men at night would risk their lives by dragging the dead out of the hospital basement, across the road, and had lined them up in an orchard. And there was this astonishing sight of 200 or 300, maybe I exaggerate, maybe it was only 100, I forget, but certainly no less than 100, all laid out in a straight line, just the corpses, uncovered, just bodies lying there, and they'd scrawled a number on the hands. Some of the rain had washed some of it away, but that's how they were keeping a record of their dead. Some of them were scorched, just charcoal. It was an absolutely horrific sight. But worse was to come, because unknown to us, while we were filming, as we left the hospital and started to film around town and then make our way back to Belgrade to satellite our story, a major, a name I can't remember now, it's one of those Serb names, had taken all the walking wounded out of the hospital and put them into lorries, take them a few miles down the road, and had beaten them, and then put them into other trucks and took them off and lined them up and then machine gunned them down. Over 200, I think 250, he just machine gunned them down, and he became perhaps the most infamous of all the mass graves in Croatia. I later met a man who had been in the army. And when he was put into this lorry, he knew what was going to happen to them all. And he told them in the truck, we must get away because they're going to kill us. And none of them believed it. So he jumped out of the truck and lay in a ditch, terrified, unable to move, too terrified to move. And within an hour, he just heard these long bursts of machine gun fire. And he realized that what he thought would happen had happened. And he managed to escape and get back to Zagreb, and I interviewed him some years later. And I remember his face as he tried to describe sitting in that ditch and listening to the machine gun fire. And he later gave evidence at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. So that was Vukovar. It took a long time, I must say, for me and my crew to get over Vukovar. It was possibly one of the worst things I've ever experienced.
I seem to remember that you filmed refugees. I can remember streams of very pathetic
people. Yes, there are streams of refugees moving out. I remember one, we filmed this little old lady dressed in black, almost bent double. She was carrying the only thing she had in the world, two huge bags, and she was struggling along this street of rubble. And suddenly there was a burst of machine gun fire, and we heard some mortar go off, and we heard her say something, you know, kind of under her breath, but we could just about pick it up on the mic. And I thought she was saying, "Oh God help us, you know, and God save the poor soul." Boom, 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 boom. Actually, when we got it back to the editing suite, our translator said she was swearing like a trooper. He said the language was unrepeatable. The other